You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Welcome to Just Believe Radio. I am your host, Lisa Tarvis, and we're not doing readings tonight, actually. So for anybody who is thinking about calling in for that, that's not what the show is about tonight. But we do have a really interesting topic that is one of my favorites to talk about tonight with a very talented author. So that's what we're going to be doing with tonight's show. I want to welcome everyone to the show, and the Just Believe is actually on every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and what we do is we cover paranormal, spiritual, metaphysical. We have a lot of our shows are shows where we have a psychic reading or a psychic on that does readings for everyone on the air, and I choose some other shows every once in a while, every so many episodes. We get somebody in that is that has written a book or is doing something that I find fascinating and interesting, and I think that my guests or my listeners will as well. I'm actually a metaphysician. I'm a board-certified holistic health practitioner. I am an intuitive counselor, and I am an author as well of the book Just Believe. And I host two radio shows, both on the Right Stream Network. One is Just Believe that you're listening to right now. The other is Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss, which is our women's talk show kind of. We take on women's issues, and I co-host that with Daria Ann. That's every Thursday at 7 p.m. So be sure to tune in to that one as well. But the Right Stream Network has an incredible lineup. We were at 7 days a week, but we just had a Wednesday slot open. So, but Sundays we kick the week off with my show, Just Believe. Then on Mondays we go to Military Monday with John D. Gresham. He's on at 1 p.m. On Tuesdays we have the Right Stream. We have Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann. She interviews authors of all different genres. Wednesday is now open. We did have a Family Power Hour going then, but for personal reasons that the hosts of that show were unable to keep hosting that show. So now we're looking at a couple different things. We're looking at maybe doing something about haunting, something completely paranormal, but only paranormal and the hauntings and ghosts and things like that kind of way. We're also looking at the possibility of having a life coach on that can help people with issues in their lives, and then another thing is like a health and fitness kind of person that we're thinking about. So anybody, if you know anybody who'd be interested in hosting a show, we have that spot open on Wednesday nights, or actually Wednesdays anytime. It doesn't have to be just that night. You can do it whenever you want. You can set the time of your show for whenever you want, but contact us. You can contact me at lisa@lisatarvis.com or go to the Right Stream website, which is rightstreamradio.com. And there's a contact us form that you can fill out, and Daria Ann and I will both get that email. So, that's something to think about for anybody who's been thinking about hosting their own radio show. We are looking for the perfect fit for the Right Stream Network lineup. On Thursdays, like I said, we have Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss. And Fridays, we have our newest show that just launched just this past Friday, is the Speculative Fiction Cantina with S. Evan Townsend. That's on at 6 p.m. Eastern. It's a really great show if you're into the sci-fi kind of thing and He's got some really interesting authors on and things on that day. And then starting, I think, this Saturday, I don't know that we have a firm date for whether or not this is starting this Saturday or not, but I think it's tentatively scheduled to launch this Saturday. We have a new show that's going to be called SEO Strategies with Snapperhead. So that's going to be like our techie show. So we're really excited about the new shows that are on and the new show that we're looking to launch. And we've got a lot of great stuff going on here at the network. So like I said, if you know anybody who's interested in being part of it, interested in advertising with us, interested in sponsoring, whatever, definitely have them contact either me or go through the rightstreamradio.com website and get the information there. Tonight, we're going to be talking to Robert Kopecky, who is the author of a book called How to Survive Life and Death. And I want to read his bio before I bring him on the air, and you'll understand why this was of interest to me, I think, when we start talking to Robert, because it's definitely right up my alley of interest. Robert, okay, so born in 1956 and raised on the outskirts of San Diego, California, Robert Kopecky survived a traumatic childhood, traveled extensively as a young man, and lived a variety of lives as a ski bum, a martial artist, a factory welder, a monumental sculptor, fabricator, wow, an underground cartoonist, and finally as an award-winning illustrator, art director, and animation designer. His journeys from the Mayan underground to remote South Pacific islands, to the capitals of Europe, to the deserts of Arizona, and the canyons of New York City were punctuated by three dramatic, distinctly different near-death experiences. Eventually, the years of professional successes and personal setbacks delivered him to his own dark night of the soul. This led to a 10-year study, meditation, and service, and the eventual transpersonal realization of what life and death can be that inspired him to start joyfully passing along the lessons he'd learned in a very hard way. He and his wife divide their time between the Upper Delaware Valley in Pennsylvania and Brooklyn, New York. He continues his art, designing animation for agencies, TV and internet, and writing spiritual essays and memoir for his blog, Art, Faith, and the Coco Lion. Robert, you can find out more about Robert at on his blog, which is robertkopecky.blogspot.com. And I just spelling, if you're in the chat room, I've already put the website in the chat room, but you can go to Robert Kopecky. It's spelled R-O-B-E-R-T, and then Kopecky is K-O-P-E-C-K-Y .blogspot.com. All right, and that's where you can find more information out about Robert, about his book, and about everything that he's got going on. Robert, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Thanks for that wonderful introduction.
I'm really excited about this, and near-death experiences are one of my things. They're one of the things that fascinate me, that are of great interest to me. And I found your story because, first of all, you've had three, which is mind-blowing. But not only just that each one was so different. And I think that's what I want to open up with, is that with these three near-death experiences that you had, each one, you said, was very different than the other ones. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm getting a little bit of an echo. Right now.
Oh, that's annoying.
I will forge ahead. It's interesting because they're not that much, they're not real different from, that's better. They're not that much different from other near-death experiences you've heard about. In fact, they kind of fit some fairly standard formats for near-death experiences. You know, they were each of them different from the other. The first one was an out-of-body experience where I was in a car accident, and the very next moment found myself at the level of the top of the telephone pole near a street lamp looking down at the scene. and seeing my my body and people running out of their houses and calling the ambulance and putting my body into the ambulance and all of that kind of stuff, trying to talk to people and not being able to be heard by them, and then being shepherded off to a kind of a lovely pastoral sort of setting where a lot of important stuff was discussed, but I don't remember distinctly exactly what it was, what the content of the conversation was, but it was important stuff being hashed out, kind of, you know. And I came to about 20 hours later in that experience. The second one was of being shown scenes from your life. I was shown scenes from my life. It was as if I was in a bright white cloud, and a kind of a screen opened up in front of me and began to show these scenes that I then began experiencing again, like, you know, with my heart. It was almost interactive, kind of, you know, the technology of it. And it was not like my highlights reel. This wasn't the best of, you know, the best of Bob kind of show. These were these kind of seminal, sort of pivotal, very moving scenes that I may have forgotten about, that I probably needed to learn something from, but I hadn't, you know. And the third one was not as nice, not as neat, certainly my least enjoyable near-death experience, which is an odd distinction to have in itself. But I was beaten up by a gang of skinheads. I was knocked unconscious from behind with some blunt object, and then according to the police report, they stomped and kicked me for the better part of an hour. And that required a lot of medical repair and stuff. But that time I found myself in a darker, kind of a very safe, very secure and comfortable, but kind of a womb-like, almost like a womb-like space. And there were more sort of entities, benevolent spirits around me, who I don't really remember distinctly, but I do remember then struggling to stay, but being gently forced back into this life because I hadn't left it appropriately and I had things left to do. I had to find my authentic expression in life, so to speak. And I opened my eyes up and looked into the eyes of an emergency medical technician who looked down at me and said, "He's back." And that was that one. That happened over about 15 years, the three of them kind of spread out over 15 years.
So you didn't have any experience where there was a light or you saw your deceased loved ones or that, you know what I mean? Like some of the fancy stuff that people talk about that, you know, that you didn't talk to God or any of that kind of thing with your experiences?
No, I didn't. As I described, they're kind of classics. You know, you've heard a lot of people have talked about having them, but I didn't have those particular ones where you walk through the tunnel towards the light, or that, or if you meet Jesus, or you meet your ancestors, or any of that kind of thing. There are also, you know, I didn't really think much about near-death experiences. I kind of suppressed the meaning of those experiences for a long time in my life, until I hit that kind of dark night of the soul that you mentioned in my bio, and my life kind of turned around, and I began to study things, and this stuff crystallized for me. But since the book has been published, you know, I find myself in the middle of kind of a near-death movement, you know, and I've discovered it's approximated that up to 15% of people in the world have had near-death experiences. So that's a lot of near-death experience. There's a lot of different kinds, you know, a lot of different forms it takes.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that I did not get to read the book yet. I read some excerpts from the book and things like that. But one of the things that did seem to stand out is that you don't really concentrate the book How to Survive Life and Death and death being in parentheses. You don't really talk about the near-death experiences, and you don't really talk about the death as much as you talk about kind of life and how to live, you know, now. What is that? Why is that?
You know, I think it's because when you talk about the kind of structure that my near-death experiences had compared to other people's, you know, some people have these sort of spectacular near-death, you know, they see oceans of angels and they meet God and stuff like that, and I have no doubt that that's their experience. My experiences, I believe, were sort of tailored for me and for what my purpose should be from them. And that really is about, like the title of the book says, how to survive life and death. I don't, you know, death is life. You don't die. Consciousness doesn't stop. My consciousness didn't stop. It moved on into kind of an enhanced holistic form, unencumbered by my physical trappings, you know, in each of my experiences. So what I'm talking about is how heaven and hell is not necessarily in the afterlife, but it's available to us here and now. The differences in people's near-death experiences, I think, are attributable to the same factors as create the differences in our lives here. Some people are born into a life in a refugee camp in Jordan. Some people are born into life witnessing the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and the 12 apostles of the Mormon Church. Right? You know, some people are born into something completely different than somebody else. And I think that that's the nature of all of our lives. And so what I'm concerned about is, number one, deflating people's fears about death and the imaginary nature of fear in our lives. And then being able to help people embrace the reality of this, you know, spiritual structure that this invisible machinery, this wonderful system that lays just beneath the surface of this life that we're really all a part of, right? And then also I address people actually dealing with the death of a loved one in their life, the reality of death in this life, and how we can better cope with that too. So I really am about life, about recognizing the eternal in each other and in life, where the eternal isn't some great expanse of time, but is this very moment right now that we're always living in and that I lived in when I was in another world too, you know. It was the same thing. I was present, I was here, and that's where I need to be to get it right so that I can perceive heaven here on this earth where it's available.
Let's talk a little bit about people's fear of death, because, you know, you said, and that's something that I've always focused on, too, is trying to relieve everyone's fear of death. And what is it about your near-death experiences, what did that teach you that made you no longer fear death, and that you can teach others about not fearing death?
Yeah, well, I mean, just that there, it continues, that it was just like stepping from one room to another. Now, I didn't have a prolonged illness leading up to my death in each of these instances.
Right.
They all happened spontaneously. They were surprises. But, in fact, they were kind of amazing surprises. You know, they were kind of fascinating and wonderful in ways, too, the first two particularly. And so that aspect of having continued to experience a life, a consciousness, after, you know, I was out of this body kind of thing, is the main reason why I don't have a fear about death so much anymore. But don't ask me to prove it right now, you know?
Right, right.
I don't really want to try it again right now. That
right.
was plenty
yeah.
for me.
Yeah, I think, and three, I think three times is good, but, you know. But the next
I
one
don't
we
recommend it. Yeah. I don't recommend it as a means to self-realization.
Right.
You know, read the book and and skip my methods.
Well,
but it is for me clear that the consciousness continues, that all life on Earth engages in this field of consciousness. And when we die from this form, we can engage in consciousness without the constrictions of our form, of our human form. Without the kind of thought that we have going on all the time, without the kinds of senses that we have going on all the time, and we are still participating in this consciousness as the underlying animating, energizing field of life, you know.
What were your feelings on death before you had your first NDE?
I think they were probably pretty typical. You know, when I was a kid, I was very querulous about it. I didn't, you know, why did Grandpa die, or why did my pet die? You know, I had a cat die that I was very close to when I was a kid, and you know, then as you get older, you see more of it in your life, and I feared it naturally. It's instinctive for human beings to fear death, or for any creature to fear death in a way. So I didn't really have any presuppositions. I imagine that I think that I was always somewhat spiritual, even though I didn't have any kind of institutional religion or spirituality in my life as a kid. But I think that I was on my path then already, too. And then I witnessed a couple of deaths. I had a wonderful aunt who really helped me in my childhood to sort of ameliorate some of the difficult things I went through as a kid. And I witnessed her death. I was at her bedside when I was in my mid-20s, and that kind of set me off. That was sort of a catalyst to years of kind of destructive behavior and a difficult search, you know, a difficult search for the truth in my life.
Right. So, like, okay, so looking at you know, these experiences that you had, which obviously, I mean, three times, holy God, that's a lot of death. You know, I mean, most people will never have one experience, you know, one near-death experience, and you had three, which is amazing. Those near-death experiences, what did nearly dying, really, I mean, not just the experience of dying, but the after effect of, wow, I almost died, what did that teach you about living?
Well, it's a curious thing because, you know, some people will have a near-death experience and they are transformed by it.
Right.
Their whole life turns around and changes, and they go in a different direction that's highly spiritual, and they're answering the metaphysical impulse to transcend the delusion of separateness, and they're, you know, they are joined with God. That didn't happen for me. I kind of suppressed the incidences, and because my ego life really grabbed me and pulled me back in. So I had that right under the surface of my life all the time, but I was still trying to be who I was supposed to be. You know, I was trying to act the right way and show the right exterior kind of a thing.
Right.
So it was kind of funny like that. It seemed to have taken quite a bit for me, but the thing that it taught me, too, is that we all have a multiplicity of deaths in a way in our life. You know, it's clear to me that our soul, or that eternal part of ourself that carries on, requires a death experience for our spiritual growth, or prefers a death experience for our spiritual growth. Because you notice in regular life that we learn gratitude from the easy parts, but all the rest of what we learn in life, we usually learn from the hard stuff. So you die from being a small child to being a teenager, and you die from that into being a young adult, and you die from that into being a middle-aged person. You experience near death when your mate leaves you, or when you're fired from a big job and lose everything. There are these points in our lives where we are reduced to our simplest form, where we visit humility in such a way that we are able to grow spiritually from that point. Now, I suggest that those are near-death experiences of a sort.
Right.
The near-death experience that I had that turned my life around wasn't one of these three occasions. It was a death of the soul, where I was occupying kind of a vacuum, a spiritual vacuum, and felt completely lost and was completely reduced to my sort of humblest state. That's when my life turned around and I began meditating and studying And years after that, these episodes arose and crystallized in my life and inspired me to write this book. So that's a long answer to that question, isn't it?
No, actually, it's a good answer. It's a thorough answer, and thorough answers are always good answers. So, you know, we think that you know, people are scared. They're very afraid. They think that death is a very scary experience. Everybody dreads it, and that is completely natural, I think.
Sure.
People to fear death. But it is. I mean, it's just like being born. Being born and dying are natural experiences that every single one of us is going to have. You know, there's no way to get out of dying. At least nobody's figured it out yet. So why do you think it is so scary? Why do you think it scares people so much to think about that?
You know, I think that it's a function, like everything else in this life, it's a function of the form we're in, right? We're human beings, so we've got all the stuff that goes along with the package, so to speak. And part of that is the way our brains think about things. We have this kind of ancient part of our brain that wants life, that wants to stay alive, that wants to eat, that wants to win, that fuels the struggle, you know, that kind of thing. And so that's completely natural and understandable. Then there's also this aspect that if we're thinking we're alive, if you take up a meditation practice, you can eventually get to a point where you can recognize your thinking from a different perspective. You see that your brain is a thinking organ. It thinks like a shark swims, right? It can't stop. It keeps going and going and going. And lots of the time, it's pretty crazy, even. When you sit in meditation long enough, you can become a witness to that. So who are you really? This place of stillness, right? This serene, intuitive intelligence that's able to see the human thought pattern all the time. Part of that human thought pattern does not want consciousness to end. It feels that if consciousness ends, it's obliteration. So it can't see beyond its own life. It can't see either way beyond its own life. It doesn't remember consciousness before being born, and it doesn't know consciousness after death. And so everybody is afraid that they're going to be obliterated to consciousness, that they're not going to experience consciousness anymore. Well, I'm here to tell you that's not true. You will experience it, and you'll experience it in an enhanced way, in my experience. So there really are these sort of constraints. In fact, I even think that we're riding around in these bodies so we can learn some difficult lessons, apparently. That's what it seems like to me.
Right.
We can only learn this way, right?
Right. I mean, there's got to be a purpose. There's got to be a reason. And, you know, and I think everybody's always... I know as a, you know, as someone who does, you know, psychic readings for people and, you know, things, I get a lot of people that come in and, okay, what is my life purpose? What is this whole thing about? Why am I here? And that's something you only figure out, you know, really by living. And
I think there's three parts to that kind of, one being evolution, the evolution of our forms, as well as our spiritual evolution, personally and collectively. The other is expression, that specific, that one thing that you can express, whether it's taking care of somebody or painting a picture or, you know, getting a car to run great or whatever it is in your life, that expression that's kind of like the force that causes flowers to blossom, you know, that kind of thing. And then I think it's love. I think that love is something of almost a quantum field in itself where we can manifest beauty and meaning out of. So when we can remove our obstacles to the flow of love into us and out of us, then, you know, there's a fulfillment that nothing else can touch. So I think those three aspects are kind of why we're here. And within that, when we can get those obstacles out of the way, you can discover your authentic self in there. And then all those other things become clearer. You start to know what your purpose is and what you're good at and
right.
that kind of thing, you know.
So what do you think the, you know, from your experiences and from writing this book as another experience, what do you think are the most important things in life?
Well, you know, I think that that's kind of obvious to everyone in a way. I mean, here's something that's really important. Honesty.
Right.
Self-honesty, right? Because when we talk about a lot of this sort of stuff, I mean, even if you look at things that are called paranormal, for example, ESP or transpersonal communication, well, it's been proven to exist over and over again at levels that occur way beyond statistical coincidence, you know.
Right.
We know that. If you look at quantum physics that we use in our telephones and our microwaves, but we still don't seem to understand that it is magical, you know. It is. It has to do with consciousness manifesting matter out of thin air, kind of, right? There's non-locality and entanglement and all these kinds of things going on. There's a profound magic at work all the time. And what was your question again?
Yeah, don't you love that? You get, like, I do that all the time. All the time that happens to me. I'll get on a subject and I'm like, I don't even remember what the question was I was trying to answer here.
But I get so excited talking about it.
I know. Believe me, I have this happen all the time to me. We're talking about what the most important things in life are from a viewpoint, of your viewpoint, which would be having three near-death experiences.
And I got off on talking about quantum physics again. It's hard for us to be honest about what's really going on here, you know.
Right.
When we talk about a spiritual life, we're talking about being spirits, inhabiting these bodies, inhabiting this kind of magical realm that is the incredibly thin veneer of life on this planet.
Right.
And living in accord with the life of the planet, which we're kind of having trouble doing right now collectively. And then love, you know, finding love in your life, expressing love in your life, having love show you the things that you love, the forms that make the most sense to you, that are most desirable to you, you know, that kind of stuff. It's easy to see when somebody cooks with love. Everybody recognizes it with that, but it exists in art and architecture and music and, you know, gardening and all kinds of things. You can see the love there. It's showing you. The way we steward the earth, in fact, is an example of that. So that's the most important stuff. Honesty and love, I say in the book, honesty plus love equals all solutions. That's my formula.
I've got lots more questions for you that I want to take a short break here and we'll come back with more from Robert Capecchi and his book How to Survive Life and Death, and we'll be right back, everyone. Hold on.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
The Speculative Fiction Cantina is your weekly hypodermic injection of science fiction, fantasy, horror, alternate history, and things weird and wonderful in the world of books and writers. You'll hear from writers who bend the rules and drive the narrative. We ask authors the hard questions. We do the show in our pajamas. Join S. Evan Townsend on this journey over the rainbow and through the looking glass. The Speculative Fiction Cantina. On Right Stream Radio every Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern.
Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network. Tune in to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, author, military historian, and journalist. John delves into a unique aspect of U.S. military history, as well as current events and issues affecting our men and women in uniform. Featuring exceptional guests, military experts, and authors, Military Monday with John D. Gresham entertains, informs, and encourages listeners to support those who put it all on the line for freedom. Military Monday with John D. Gresham. Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
We are back. You're listening to Just Believe Radio on the Right Stream Network. And we're talking tonight with Robert Kopecky, who wrote the book, How to Survive Life and Death. And we've been talking, Robert, about your near-death experiences and all of that. But one of the things that you talk about in your book is throughout, I think throughout a lot of the book, from what I've been able to see so far, are three tips for happiness. Can you describe those?
Sure. Yeah. I'd be glad to. If I can remember them, I busted out a windshield with my head. I busted a windshield with my head, and then I got hit with a tire iron. It was a long time ago, but sometimes it crops up again.
What I'm
talking about is that there is this there's this invisible machinery that's just beneath the surface of this material world that we're inhabiting, and it's there, but we don't always feel it. You know, we are, I believe, sixth sensory creatures. I think we're all getting more and more capable of experiencing the spiritual all the time.
Right.
And so, but there are ways that you can access it to bring it into your life and make use of it a little bit more easily. And those are what I call in the book three tips for happiness, because they happen to have a happiness as a side effect, kind of, you know. Mm-hmm. The first one is radical kindness. Radical kindness, radical forgiveness, and radical surrender. And radical kindness, I pose it as a challenge to people. You be as absolutely, authentically, and sincerely kind to everyone you meet during the course of your day, no matter what the situation is, and watch what happens. It is really transformative. It's really an amazing, amazing thing, because you begin to identify so completely with people that when you're open-hearted that way, you discover that there is this fabric of kindness that's running through all of life. All these friends start to appear. All these coincidences start to happen. And you're joined to life in a completely different way, you know?
Yeah.
I've had people hand me things I didn't know that I needed just before I needed them, and they were people that I didn't even know were there, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And it just came from just looking them in the eye and smiling with my eyes and opening my heart and being friendly. And then when you get that back, it will change your life, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's first one, and that's probably the funnest one, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because radical forgiveness is usually taking place when, you know, somebody done you wrong, or you're grieved somehow. You're having a difficult time often because a relationship has gone bad or that sort of thing. Or you're angry at yourself for having blown something, you know, that you thought you should have done better or that sort of thing. And in that case, it really has to do with more of that same identification of realizing that this is not an easy life and that everyone is trying their best, and that when somebody does something bad to you, it's often a result of the trauma and the pain in their life that they are expressing, and you just happen to be in the line of fire, you know.
Yeah.
And if you, if you choose to hold on to that and carry that pain, their pain, with you, then it will become your pain too. And you don't need to do that. You can set it down and, you know, move on to learn your own lessons and to live your own life and not to be defined that way. It's very difficult because our mind, our brain will play the loop of the hurt over and over. You know, the story of the hurt done to you will play over and over. And so it really takes it takes persistence, you know. You have to be vigilant and you have to stay with it. You have to keep pushing that reset button and letting go in your heart and moving on from that. And then radical surrender, of course, is tough because it just doesn't rub people the right way, you know. Especially if you've got a survivor's instinct or a you have the soul of a fighter, kind of, you know. It's like, me surrender? Never.
Right.
I'll fight to the bitter end. Well, the fact is that we're subject to a lot of large forces that are beyond our control in this life, and the universe is going to win. The universe is going to direct your life the way it's going to be directed. Now, that's not to say that we can't make things happen in our life, because naturally we can with our focus and imaginations. But you end up not fighting until the bitter end. You just end up being bitter a lot, you know, because there is no end, too. It continues on. And so what you carry with you in this life, you will carry on into your next life. I believe that very much.
Yeah, I totally agree. One of the other things that you have and that you talk about in the book that I totally agree with is the connection, you know, us not giving animals, our pets and animals enough credit and enough, I have this feeling that they are so much more connected spiritually than we are. And I know you also reference that in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's one of the great tragedies of the world right now is the way that animals are being treated. If you look back at the popular biblical metaphor of the garden, right? The Garden of Eden.
Right.
The animals are still there. The animals still live in the garden. We got kicked out.
Right.
And we got kicked out because we decided we were better than the natural creations of the world that we live in, and that we have some kind of dominance, right, over them, and that we can manipulate them, exploit them, that sort of thing. We know what right and wrong is, what's good and evil, and that kind of assuming God's position in that case is leading to a lot of problems, particularly for our animal brothers and sisters who share consciousness with us, you know, who who live in an unencumbered state, I think, you know, much closer, like you said, much closer to the divine. We experience it when we're in nature. If you're in a beautiful place in nature, you notice that the membrane to the divine is much thinner, right? It's not like being downtown.
Absolutely.
It's a lot easier to experience the way that animals are connected to the world all the time. And we also sell them short when it comes to their intelligence. I mean, there are some fellows just recently, just for kicks, they gave an MRI scan to their dog and discovered that their dog scanned like about a 6 or 7 year old child, you know. And we know that elephants and crows and cetaceans like dolphins and porpoises and whales are incredibly intelligent. They have large brains. They think very well. They're subject to their sensory input, which comes in a different way than ours, which is superior to ours in many, many ways. But, you know, we have thinking, which is a double-edged sword. Most of the terrible things I've done in my life, I thought about a lot first, unfortunately.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So it really is not fair. We really need to start to consider our animal brothers and sisters as just that, you know, as companions on this celestial spaceship that we're on together, and to bring them into our lives. We already bring our pets into our lives to attach us to the divine. I mean, everybody knows that a cat in your lap is love, you know.
Right,
You experience that, and everyone... I've had people, my wife is an animal communicator, and I've seen people deride her, sort of make fun of her, and then the same person later that day scolding their dog and trying to drag it on their leash and turning around and saying, now you shouldn't have done that, oh come on, let's go, you know.
Right.
They're talking to their animals too, so that's
Absolutely.
Again honesty, you know, if we're being honest about what's going on here. We all know in our hearts that animals are intelligent, sentient beings, right?
Right, absolutely. I think that is so accurate because I've seen it with my own animals. I have an Australian Shepherd that I swear can read my mind. It's like, I'll just think, oh, I got to remember to put Boomer's eardrops in today, and he goes running under the bed.
Right.
I mean, well, I just thought, and I'm like, what? How do you know that I just, because he hates having his eardrops put in, you know? And I'm like, how does he do that? You know?
Yeah,
I think that they're so smart.
There's this, there's an academician named Rupert Sheldrake, who's a scientist, and he's done a series of experiments, video experiments, that you can find on YouTube, where he will engage the owner of a pet in town, like say 2-3 miles away from home, and set up a video camera in the home filming their dog. And when the person leaves and starts walking towards the car to get in their car and drive home, the dog will get up. And then if he reengages the person, says, hey, come back here, I want to talk to you a little more, the dog will lay back down. And then when the person actually goes to the car to get in and drive home, when they're about halfway home, the dog will get up and walk to the window and stand and wait in the window. That kind of thing, you know. So they do have ESP. They do communicate with one another psychically, too.
Right.
A lot of ways. They communicate in all kinds of ways that just because they can't talk like we do, we don't think are valid, but I think we're wrong about that.
I agree. Talk to me about your views on reincarnation.
Well, obviously I believe in it. You're right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty clear, and if you study it at all, once again, you run into this preponderance of evidence that, you know, people who can describe villages from 200 years ago perfectly. I tell the story of a true story of a fellow in the book who was watching a documentary on television about the excavation of an ancient site, and he knew what they were doing, and so he got in touch with them, and they actually flew him to the site, and he was able to direct their digging into different parts of these ancient ruins, 2,500 years old. And so, you know, if you just think about baby Mozart being able to create a concerto at age 5, I just don't think a kid between 1 and 4 learns everything you need to know to do that, you know.
Right.
So it seems quite clear to me that as part of this continuum of consciousness that I'm talking about, it certainly reincarnation is part and parcel of that.
So, you know, one of the other things you talk about a lot is meditation, and I want to cover that because I am, you know, I try to teach people how to meditate, and people struggle so much with meditating. And I think sometimes they're thinking that they're supposed to blank out their minds and not have any thoughts
right.
while they're meditating, which is impossible. Our brains
right.
think. That's the only thing it does.
Yeah, that's right.
What it's there yeah. for. So I think people really struggle with that. But you kind of had some tips in your book about how to effectively meditate.
Yeah, well, meditation changed my life entirely. I mean, I was really something of a mess before I started meditating, and I was still a mess for a while. It took me a while to meditate to improve things in there.
Right.
But I meditated the same way. I used to sit and think, okay, I'm meditating now. I'm meditating. Now I'm meditating. I'm sitting here. I'm meditating. Okay, that was a good meditation. I'm done. That's enough of that, you know, that sort of thing. But for me, after all this time that I've spent doing it, it breaks down to sort of three paths. One I find is a sort of analytical, where you sit and you observe your thoughts, you know, almost like watching a movie, like you're sitting in the audience and you're watching a movie screen and here come your thoughts on parade, one after another, always sequential. The Zen people talk about waves, you know, or ripples on a pond. Here comes one, here comes another, they pass, then it's smooth, then they pass. Then, you know, you witness them. And when you get good, or you get a little more used to practicing that, to witnessing them, then who is witnessing what? You know, who are you and who are your thoughts? If you're sitting in a place of calmness and serenity where you can see your thoughts coming and going, what if you are sitting in that place of serenity all the time? Then you can start to disengage from your thoughts the way we all commonly do when we say, hey, I don't even want to think about that. You know,
right.
We all already practice some of that mindfulness naturally.
Right.
Another way is to do it the physical way, where you count your breaths. You know, you breathe in and you breathe out, and you try to get in sync with your heartbeat, and you feel the blood rushing out to your fingertips, and when you close your eyes, it's not blackness you see inside of your eyes. You see this kind of energetic dance going on, right? You know, these kind of waves of light forms and stuff. And what is that all about if not the internal energies of your being that you're witnessing? So the third way then is to have a point of devotion, like a Jesus or Buddha or an oak tree or your cat, you know. Something that you can focus your heart on. And all three of these are means to take you out of yourself or to disengage you from that serial thinking that we're all subject to all the time and find that kind of peace that makes you aware of your unity with everything. That's, you know, you gain control over your thoughts, which is very helpful, and when you're doing that, you sit in that serene place, you also start to recognize that you're part of everything and everything is part of you. So it's a beautiful experience.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. I don't think it's something that comes naturally to very many people. I do think it's just like anything else. If you want to do it well, you've got to practice. And it does, you know,
yes,
it does take some work and some practice to get to a place where, you know, and I always tell people, I meditate, some of my best meditating is while I'm doing dishes or while I'm vacuuming.
Right.
You know what I mean? It doesn't have to be you sitting in the lotus position. You know,
exactly.
It has to be that way. You can meditate anytime at all. And,
yeah, different forms, running or mowing the lawn or all kinds of ways. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I sometimes I think people who exercise, like running especially, runners run a lot of times. I think they get so addicted to it because that's their time. That's that meditation time that they're getting. Just they're not assigning the word meditation to it. They're assigning the word exercise, but I think that's what they're getting from it as well as the other benefits, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some relief from the sort of incessant demands of thought, you know, worries. Worries are imaginary, most of them. I've probably spent years worrying about things that never happened.
Right.
I heard the expression the other day that worrying is like carrying an open umbrella around with you all the time because it might rain. You know, that kind of thing. And when you're jogging, you tend to disengage in that. You're more into your physical motion, and you hit this kind of plateau where thought is not as important as it usually is.
Right. Yeah, I think that's really true. I think that and the worry thing. Oh my gosh, so many people. You know, I used to worry about everything too until I got to the point where I'm like, you know what, worrying is getting me sick. It's making me.
Yeah.
And if I can control it, then I, you know, whatever the issue is, if I can control it, what the hell am I doing worrying about it? Because I can fix it, you know.
Right.
And if you can't control it, what the hell are you doing worrying about it? Because you have no power over it anyway. You know?
That's right.
It's just a waste of time, and obviously a really, you know, difficult emotion to experience. You know,
and that's kind of the nature of a lot of pain. You know, a lot of pain is self-imposed, and unfortunately, it's telling you something, right? It's telling you something you need to focus on. If you've got a pain in your side that keeps persisting, you need to go to the doctor and have it checked out.
Right.
You know, if you're worrying about your taxes, you need to sit down with your accountant.
Absolutely.
You know? It's usually pretty direct. It kind of goes back to honesty again, some of that. So,
it's one of those things where I wasted so much energy over way too many years worrying about things that should not have ever been on my radar, as a worry, because it was not something that, you know, that I had any power over at all.
Yeah, you spend all that time, and then it just comes and goes right past you, and nothing bad happens. Or even if something, you know, quote-unquote bad happens, it's very instructive, and it teaches you not to do that again, right? And it teaches you to pay more attention to that worry, to that pain when it shows up the next time.
Right.
Like, I've been here before, and I'm not going to do it that way again. Right?
Exactly. Learned a lesson, you know, let's not do that. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found most fascinating when I read your bio, originally, I think when I was first going over your information to be a guest on the show, was your past career and how the heck did you end up going from what you were to where you are? You know, I mean, like I read in your bio, you've been an illustrator, a designer, you've had major publications and network TV credits. In fact, I think I read somewhere you designed some of the stuff for the show Weeds.
Yeah, I designed the last season's opening credits for Weeds. That was me. I drew all that stuff and did that animation. So
yeah, I loved that show, by the way. I thought that show was awesome. I don't know why.
Yeah, it was funny. Yeah, it was an interesting show. I had to binge watch it to do that job. I had to watch 6 seasons in a week.
Yeah. Okay, Netflix. Netflix becomes my best friend.
Right.
Do a lot of catching up here. Yeah.
Well, I did. I had a lot of different lives, you know, and Joseph Campbell said something that really resonates with me, and that is that when you look back at your life, it tends to be this kind of remarkable script that sort of couldn't have been written in any other way, kind of. I mean, you can imagine all kinds of fantasies for how your life could have gone or should have gone or whatever. But when you're really honest and you look back at it, it's really a remarkably scripted thing. And, you know, I had a kind of an oddly mystical childhood and young life. I didn't realize that's what it was at the time, but, you know, when I was a little boy living on the border down by Mexico in San Diego, my dad had a business with a lot of Mexicans working for him, and there was an elderly Yaqui Indian gentleman who used to stop by his truck lot, and he would bounce me on his knee and tell me stories of the little star people and their beautiful starships that he used to ride around in, you know. My mom took us to look for Bigfoot when I was 10 years old in 1966, you know, way before Bigfoot even had an agent, you know. I was present for the Phoenix Lights back in 2006, I think it was. And I was in downtown Manhattan during 9/11. I've had all kinds of crazy things happen in my life. And sitting on a rock by the Upper Delaware River helped bring them all together to me and start putting it in a form that I could, you know, pass along to people what this incredible thing that we call life is all about.
Right. We're going to wrap it up here in a minute, and I want everybody to know your website again, which is robertkopecky.blogspot.com, and Robert's last name is spelled K-O-P-E-C-K-Y. Your book, How to Survive Life and Death, is available everywhere books are sold. So if you're, you know, if you buy through a Kindle or, you know, Amazon Kindle, or you buy for your iPad through whatever app, you can get it. You can buy it on hard copy. I'm sure people are still doing that.
Oh, it's not in hard copy. It's only in paper.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So,
and, you know,
yeah.
I like to tell people to look at their local bookstore too, you know, or to ask for it at their local bookstore, because I like local bookstores and want them to continue, you know.
Yeah. No, that's a really good idea. I agree with that. Everybody, you know, I'm downloading my books. So I'm always doing, you know, I'm on my iPad downloading books, and that's just how I get everything. But I agree that, you know, if you're gonna actually go and buy the copy of a book, a physical copy of the book, it's really kind of nice to be able to do that at a local bookstore.
Yeah.
I know you. So you also have, besides obviously your website and your book, you have an event coming up in Manhattan. Why don't you tell everybody about that and anything else you wanna mention before we end the show?
I do, yeah. Thank you so much for bringing that up. For any of your listeners that are in the New York area or going to be in the New York area this coming Friday, October 17th, I'm going to be having an event at Namaste Bookshop. That is on 14th Street, right near 5th Avenue, near Union Square in Manhattan, at 6:30 p.m. It'll be a signing and discussion, a reading, a discussion, and a signing kind of thing. And, you know, your listeners can also go to my Facebook author page. I have a lot of media on there. My blog site, I do a lot of writing of spiritual stuff, and I also write. Nowadays, I'm writing for Gaiam TV, and I'm on BeliefNet and Soul Lifetimes. The Utney Reader just excerpted a part of the book, and the MindfulWord.org. I'm there all the time too, so I'm finding myself being a writer at night and on the weekends. Actually, but. All those places, I'd love it if they'd come and visit me there.
Well, that's awesome. That's great, and I'm glad you were able to get that information out there. So it's Namaste Bookstore on 14th Street, I think you said, in Manhattan,
yeah.
Right?
That's right, yeah, 6:30 this coming Friday.
All right, everybody, you want to, if you're in the area, and I know we have lots of listeners from New York, so if you're in the area and you can make it there, stop by and see Robert live in person. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. I really, really appreciate it. It's a fascinating topic to me, and I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you so much, Lisa. It's been a really great pleasure. You're wonderful with your questions, and I had a terrific time. And thanks to all your listeners out there.
Thank you. Thanks so much. We'll talk soon. All right, everyone. That was Robert Kopecky. You can find his book in bookstores online and regular old bookstores, you know, that we avoid for some reason. I used to love the smell of a bookstore. Just walking in and smelling the bookstore. I never go into bookstores anymore. I gotta change that. I gotta start working on that. But anyway, Robert's book is called How to Survive Life and Death, and his website, again, is robertkopecky.blogspot.com. And if you're in the chat room, I've typed it in there, so all you've got to do is click. So that's it for tonight's show. Just want to let everyone know that next week we are going to be doing readings, and it's going to be me doing the readings. I decided to, every so many episodes, do them myself. Do the readings myself, because I kind of know what I'm doing with this stuff, you know? Everybody remember the top secret stuff that I tell everybody if they make it to the end of the show every week. You can start calling in at about 6:45 for when we're doing the psychic readings. If you call in at 6:45, you will get to be further up in the queue. So people that call in after the show's begun are less likely to get on. The people that call in before the show begins are more likely to get on. So next week's guest is me. I'm next week's guest on my own show. How cool is that? I get to talk nonstop. My favorite thing to do, talk nonstop. While I'm on the air. So that's very cool. Anyway, so everybody tune in for that next week. Also, remember to check out my website at lisatarvis.com, LISATARVES.com. Buy my book, too, people. When you're out there picking up Robert's How to Survive Life and Death, make sure you pick up a copy of Just Believe, because, I like when people buy my book. So Just Believe is available wherever books are sold as well. And go to my website, see everything I have to offer, everything that I'm doing. Take a little bit of time to do that. Go to rightstreamradio.com and check out all of the amazing shows we have on the Rightstream Network right now, plus all of the information on all of our hosts and where you can find out more about our hosts as well as more about the shows. Next up in the lineup is tomorrow's Monday, Military Monday with John D. Gresham. That's at 1 p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow. And until next week, everybody, it's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for listening and for staying tuned in this week. And I'll talk to you all next week. Bye.